Is that
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, scattered through the scriptures of the world are affirmations of a great realization. The poet seers of the Rig Veda, such as Kashyapa, Pragatha, Brihadeva, Prajapati Parameshtin, Vamadeva, and a host of others, stated that they had discovered the gods, attained the light, realized immortality. In the Gathas of the Avasta, which are the scriptures of Iran, Zarathustra affirms, "Then did I behold thee as the most bountiful one, O Ahura Mazda, when the good mind encircled me completely." Perhaps the first words of the Buddha after the enlightenment, when he speaks to his group of five bhikkhus, were, "The deathless has been won." If you look at the Old and the New Testaments, you will find certain extraordinary statements. In Genesis, in the 5th chapter, it is said that Enoch walked with God, and Enoch was not, for God took him. It is said of his predecessors up to Adam, and of his successors up to Noah, that they all lived so many years and died. But of Enoch, it is only said he lived 365 years and he walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. You also know that remarkable narration in the second book of Kings, where Elijah and Elisha walk along together talking, and then suddenly there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted Elijah and Elisha asunder, and Elijah was taken up by a whirlwind into heaven. We find statements like this scattered through all the scriptures, and particularly in the Upanishads, you find the great affirmation that he who realizes Brahman becomes Brahman, or realizes the Atma becomes immortal, realizes immortality here now whilst alive in this world. You remember also the words of Jesus, "I and the Father are one. Believe me, I am in the Father, and the Father in me." The end of the Katha Upanishad is particularly interesting for all of us who are concerned with yoga. That Upanishad gives a description, or attempts to give a description, of the conversation between Nachiketas and the Lord of Death. And the Upanishad ends thus: "Then Nachiketas, having gained this teaching from the Lord of Death and the whole rule of yoga, attained Brahman and became free from death. And so may any other who knows this." The Mundaka Upanishad states that he who knows Brahman becomes Brahman. He crosses over sin, he crosses over sorrow. Liberated from the knots of the heart, he becomes immortal. Note those words carefully. He crosses over sin. He crosses over sorrow. In the 7th chapter of the Chandogya Upanishad, the saintly sage Narada approaches his teacher Sanat Kumara and begs him to declare the truth about Brahman. Sanat Kumara tells him, "Tell me first what you know, and then I will tell you further." Narada gives a succinct table of contents of all he knows. And we may deduce that he was one of those extraordinary people with an encyclopedic knowledge. "But," says Narada, "I am as one who only knows the sacred sayings, the words. I have heard from those who are like you, sir, that he who knows the Atma crosses over sorrow. I am a sorrowing one. Do you teach me how to realize the Atma and cross over all sorrow?" Now, it is very important for us to appreciate the significance of the meaning of sorrow in the religious context. The religious context is the context of transcendence, not the worldly context. You will notice that all the great teachers of the world were profoundly stirred by the sorrow of human beings in the world of affairs in a worldly manner. But if you study the religions of the world carefully, and above all live them, you will discover this extraordinary thing, that the answer they gave was not in worldly terms, nothing to do with politics or economics or social organization or education or anything at all. But their answer was the transcendent answer, and the transcendent answer only. This is extremely significant. So now, the terms used are Brahman, Atma. What do these terms mean? There are tomes and tomes, philosophic works expounding Brahman and Atma. But if you yourself have ever been able to be touched by the reality of Brahman and Atma, you will discover something quite extraordinary. When you yourself are utterly purified, when all evil-mindedness is completely burnt out of you, when you yourself are emerged in that silence which is the transcendent reality of being, then the one total reality comes to full consciousness through you. It is not that you have attained anything at all. You are not. It is the one total reality. It is transcendence itself that flows in and flows out of you, because you are now utterly unresisting. You are a transparent, purified focal point for this which is beyond anything that we know in our ordinary mortal existence. And it is this state in which you are, which is the meaning of the word Brahman, the meaning of the word Atma. You will see, therefore, how this goes right beyond any sort of logical, discursive, intellectual presentation. And it is most important, if we are to be yogis in the real sense, not only to understand this intellectually as a starting point, but to realize it in terms of that awareness where all isolative self-consciousness is completely out. Isolative self-consciousness is the trouble. Now, yoga is the way, the means by which man realizes freedom. I should say a way, a means by which man realizes freedom from isolative self-consciousness. And when that happens, he is rejoined to the one total reality. He is restored into the harmony of the whole. This rejoining, this restoration, is the real meaning of yoga and the state of yoga. The word, as probably all of you know, is derived from the root yuj, meaning to yoke or to join together. Now we must appreciate that in this rejoining, there is nothing for me as a separate entity. If I take to yoga, or if I take to any spiritual discipline for the sake of obtaining some material, worldly result, for the sake of helping others, as I say, serving God or man or whatever you like, all of which are only projections of my separate self magnified, then I am making a mistake, to put it very gently. There must be no self-seeking whatsoever. This is fundamentally important. If you want to be a real yogi, perhaps if you appreciate that, you will understand the significance of those words in the Old Testament. And Enoch was not. He was not. There was only the one total absolute reality. See, this utter purity of approach means that the yogi has to scale the height of sinlessness and plumb the depth of selflessness. And this is no light task. Now, all yoga, and you know there are various so-called different yogas, mantra yoga, laya yoga, hatha yoga, raja yoga, karma yoga, bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, and so forth, all of them essentially consist of eight elements, eight aspects. The first is called yama, which is self-discipline, self-control, forbearance, and the fulfillment of all morality. Of morality, realizing purity. And this has no compromise possible with the ways of the world. That is Yama. The next is Niyama, which we may translate as religious observances. Somewhat corresponding to what in Christianity we call the external instruments of grace. There are some correspondences, not altogether. Then there is asana, posture, pranayama, which is breath control, that's the usual translation, but we shall consider some other meanings too of these two words. Then there is pratyahara, usually translated as the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. I think it would be wiser to look at it this way: freedom from attachment to or aversion from all sense objects. Then there is dharana. Dharana literally means a holding. Some translate it as concentrating the mind. All sorts of translations are given. But the word dharana is derived from the root dhri, which means to uphold. And its essential meaning is to uphold continuously the awareness of Brahman. You may wonder why there are these two words, Brahman and Atma. Why not just one word alone? We can put it quite simply and precisely. How did the yogis realize Brahman? How did they realize Atma? Asking the question, what is the ultimate reality, the objective search, they ended up with the realization which they termed Brahman. Asking the question, who am I, they ended their search with the realization which they called Atma. Atma is subjective in flavor, Brahman is objective. Now, the point is this: Brahman and Atma, they declared, were absolutely identical. How do you get such an identity? Bear in mind that mankind through the ages has always placed the transcendent outside himself, up above there, not here, not in me. I am the mortal creature only. But these people said, no, Brahman and Atma, the objective and the subjective ultimates, are identical, for the very simple reason that whilst the questions were couched in the objective and subjective form, the way which led them to the final result was the identical way, namely that of the complete denudation of the mind. The denudation of the mind. The freeing of the mind completely from all its accumulated memories, beliefs, convictions, desires, and all the rest of it. When that mind was completely denuded, it entered into its own. It became completely transparent. And then the awareness which shone through that transparent mind as the result of the objective search was termed Brahman. And that same answering the question, who am I, was termed Atma. If Brahman were to say I, then that I is the meaning of the word Atma. When you and I say I, we merely mean this isolated, self-conscious, separated entity, entity divorced from the one total reality. There is the root of all sorrow and misery in life. So you see how important it is to understand the reality of I. In the Tejobindu Upanishad, the great god Shiva answers Kumara the Kartikeya in a long discourse in which he says, among so many other wonderful things, one extraordinary thing. Remember, he's the great god Shiva. I am the I which has given up I. So now, dharana, the upholding continually this awareness of the transcendent reality, the one total reality. Then we have dhyana, which is the definite act of contemplation through the various stages of dhyana. In Buddhism, we use the term jhana. The Sanskrit word is dhyana. And finally, the eighth, samadhi. Samadhi has also been translated in various ways. But I can't think of a better translation in the English language than the English word communion. Samadhi is the peak point of yoga. It is communion. And as you probably already know, there are two aspects to this communion. The communion in which there is still this separative consciousness of thou and I. But when one crosses over the limitation of regarding the total reality, the transcendent, as something other than oneself, then it is not thou and I. There is only it, the ultimate real. It is not you and I, it is us. And an us in which the separation does not exist. It's a non-duality. That is samadhi, which Patanjali, for example, in his Yoga Sutras, talks of as the asampranyata samadhi. The samadhi where there are the two, thou and I, is called the sampranyata samadhi. This is the asampranyata samadhi. But either way, it is the state of communion. It is this state which is the meaning of the statement realizing immortality here and now. Immortality has nothing to do with continuity in time and space. Nothing at all. For you and for me, there is absolutely no continuity in time and space. There is neither the survival of personality, nor is there annihilation. Be careful, these are terrible doctrines, if you like. One has to be very strong, very balanced, very capable, in order to absorb them and understand them and blossom out into one's true humanity. Now, yama is the first preliminary, the essential basis for yoga, absolute purity. Why? Yoga involves the utilization of power, of psychical and spiritual energies. He is a foolish one who tampers with power. All of us know something about the history of man, of our own country, or of the world generally. Have we not seen through the ages that power, even in the worldly sphere, is inevitably and invariably misused? Inevitably and invariably, unless there is the preliminary basis of the harmony of love and wisdom which have come to fruition. Then only power may be handled safely, because it is no longer the separately self-conscious you whose interests will clash with somebody else's interests who is handling power. It is only the one total reality, the transcendent real, which is manifesting its power in the world. Therefore, the supreme importance of the basis of purity, and this is yama. I would like to suggest a meaning of yama which you won't find in the Sanskrit dictionary as such. But I have found it suggested in some work which I read many years ago. Unfortunately, I cannot quote chapter and verse. There are too many things I've forgotten now at my age. And it is this: yama can be regarded as mortification. Now, not mortification in the monkish sense of torturing oneself. Not a bit of it. Not for a moment, therefore, am I condoning indulging oneself. Mortification really means this. You know that the immediate now is the only reality here for us. The immediate now. The previous moment is gone. It is dead. The future is not yet here. The immediate moment is now. If we are wholly and completely attentive to the immediate moment, we completely work out everything that belongs to the immediate moment. And therefore, there is nothing left over. If we do that, we let the totality of the now go completely into the past, and we are free. And this means that from moment to moment, if we are to live completely and fully, we have to die utterly to every moment as it passes into the dead past. And that is the real mortification. Allowing the immediate now in its totality to die completely as it flows into the past. The yogi does this. Can you and I do it? No. Why? We hold on to the things of the present out of fear, out of desire. Therefore, we drag into the immediate now the corpses of the past. And this is what burdens us and weighs us down. These corpses of the past. So now, the importance of yama regarded as mortification. Now, the Shandilya Upanishad gives a list of all these yamas. There are 10 in this list. Several of the other Upanishads also give 10, and some give more, some give less. You have to look into the whole of them in order to get all that you can out of the Upanishads. Harmlessness, truth, non-covetousness, continence, kindliness, equanimity, patient endurance, steadiness of mind in gain or loss, abstemiousness in eating and drinking, cleanliness of body and mind. Those are the 10 that the Shandilya Upanishad gives. Patanjali, in his Yoga Sutras, gives only 5. He gives harmlessness, truth, non-covetousness, continence, and as the 5th, non-greediness, non-amassing of possessions. He gives just those 5. But the Upanishads give, in most cases, much longer, fuller lists. Now, in contrast to the Brahmanical presentation, which we find in the Upanishads, in Patanjali and so forth, we will find that the Buddha and his great disciples, like Sariputta, present the situation in what we would commonly call the negative form. They tell us all the evils which we have to get rid of, rather than tell us the positive good qualities that one might think one has to cultivate. And the list given is rather a tremendous list in the Buddhist scriptures. Greed, ill will and covetousness, anger, malevolence, hypocrisy, spite, envy, stinginess, deceit, treachery, obstinacy, impetuosity, arrogance, pride, conceit, indolence. There's a nice list to get rid of. But let us not think, therefore, that this psychological insight, which makes the Buddha present the situation in the negative form, is lacking in the Upanishads or in Patanjali. Far from it. Patanjali, for example, talks of the obstacles to yoga: disease or illness, dullness, doubt, carelessness, sloth, worldly mindedness, false notions, missing the point, instability. And these are accompanied, he says, in the practice of yoga, by pain, despair, nervousness, disturbed inspiration and expiration. And he adds, in the second section of the aphorisms, ignorance, the isolative ego sense, asmita. I think you'll find that is probably the best translation. Isolative ego sense. Because we have to have a self-sense, we have to be self-consciousness, otherwise we couldn't even cross the street in safety. But not the isolative self-consciousness. The Upanishads, the Yoga Tattva gives laziness, idle talk, association with bad characters. Now note carefully, dabbling with mantras, the words or phrases of power, dabbling with mantras, indulgence with the opposite sex. The Tejobindu gives absence of right inquiry or investigation, laziness, inclination to sense pleasures. And of course, the Buddha is very strong on this point. He points to the sense pleasures as perhaps the greatest obstacle to the realization of nirvana. Absorption in mundane matters, sloth, distraction, impatience, absent-mindedness. The Yoga Kundli gives discontinuing the practice of yoga out of fear of disease. Doubt, carelessness, laziness, sleep, sensuality, delusion, lack of perseverance. The Amritanada gives fear, anger, laziness, excessive eating or fasting, excessive sleeping or waking. Aristotle's golden mean, perhaps. Now, we should consider for just a few moments The psychological insight in presenting the situation in the negative form. One may say, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and soul and so forth, love thy neighbor as thyself. But do you and I know the meaning of love? We know what attraction is. We know what attachment is. We know what possessiveness is. But do you and I really love? Absolutely? Transcendentally? Or do we love conditionally? I will love you provided you will, etc. We are shopkeepers. And we have the same relationship with God. I will serve you, O Lord my God, if. And some may go so far as to feel, I didn't quite expect that of you, O Lord. So do we know this spiritual value in its positive transcendental sense? Love, similarly with wisdom, truth, goodness, beauty, take any value you like. Do we really know it? Not a bit of it. What we do know is the opposite, or that rather which goes by the name of the opposite. We know what it is to be angry, to hate, to feel ill will, to be greedy, to be lustful, to be self-indulgent. We know all that. We know what it is to be stupid, to be dull. But we don't know what it is to be wise in the religious sense, that is, in the transcendental sense. Therefore, there is remarkable psychological insight in the way in which the great teachers have presented this matter. They have asked us to look into ourselves and be mindful of everything that comes up in consciousness, and not to be misled by the apparent manifestation of what we call virtues. Virtues cannot be cultivated. You cannot seek virtue. You cannot seek ultimate truth. These things in their transcendence are there. But what we commonly call the vices are the obstructions that emerge out of us because of our state of ignorance, our self-seeking, and the urge to fulfill any desire or whim or appetite as it comes up. So, let us look to what is wrong. Remove the wrong, transform it, and what is right is there. Supposing you have a room which is dirty, you can't put cleanness into it. You can only remove the dirt. When you have removed the dirt, the room is clean. That is all. So you see, the so-called negative presentation is really the practical, the sensible one. The positive presentation is perhaps not quite so practical. Now the Yoga Tattva Upanishad says that scanty eating is the most important yama, and harmlessness is the most important niyama. This question of eating and drinking is more important than we imagine it to be. But let me say at the outset that there is no point in making a fetish in relation to what we eat and drink. If we have any good sense, we can use it. Every one of us has common sense, some degree or other. But I'm talking of good sense. It is rather a different thing. You can work that out for yourselves. What is good sense? But if we have good sense, we will be very careful as to what we eat and drink. Not merely because it is necessary to keep the body healthy. What we eat and drink undergoes a transformation and becomes this body. And this body, especially for the yogi, is that in which is locked up all power and energy. Not only energy and power in the ordinary physical scientific sense of the word, measurable energy. This whole universe that we apprehend through our senses is a universe in which there are continuous energy exchanges. The entire universal process is a system of energy exchanges. And these energies are all measurable. Electricity, heat, light, everything. Every form of energy that we know is measurable. But apart from that, there is something which modern science is perhaps just beginning to have an inkling of, but which it cannot deal with, for the very simple reason that this is immeasurable. It belongs to a dimension of being and consciousness which is not finite. And the infinite necessarily is immeasurable. It is neither big nor small, remember. It is not finite. And the realm of pure mind and the realm of the spirit, which transcends both speech and mind, have this element of the non-finite about them. And this energy, this power, is immeasurable, invisible. You can have no dealings with it. It deals with you all the time. You may ask, well, if it is infinite, immeasurable, and so forth, how can you talk about it? If you live in terms of purity, if you live in such a manner that you awake, really awake to these deep things, you will be transformed by it, by this energy, and you will know it. You will know the transformation, but you will never know how that energy works. That is the unknowable, but it works. And the person is transformed. The person is different. That is how all the old holy ones knew these things and made certain suggestions which could be helpful to us if we also take the trouble to become purified and become silent and quiet within ourselves. A silence which is not the mere opposite of noise or sound, but which completely includes all sound. Because sound is only a fraction of the totality which is silence. Just as the entire physical manifested universe is just a totality, just a fraction of that immensely greater totality which we call empty space. So now, eating and drinking is concerned with the transformation of this, which embodies these energies. How these energies will be used, how they will manifest in our everyday life, is partly dependent upon what you serve up to this, the body, in terms of your food and your drink. Hence the importance. You yourself must decide what you will do about your food and your drink. I'm not out here to convert you to eating meat or to abstain from meat or become fruitarians or anything. Whatever you do, remember the basic rule of the spiritual life. Never take leave of good sense. Now the next point is harmlessness. The Yoga Tattva says harmlessness is the most important religious observance. It is one of the curious facts in the teachings of all the great religions of the world that harmlessness is emphasized perhaps more than anything else. The Buddha, for instance, made an extraordinary statement. He said, "He who lives not hurting himself, not hurting others, lives with a self become Brahman." It takes a long time, takes a lifetime of strenuous, arduous mindfulness and action to realize the significance of that statement. He who lives not hurting himself, not hurting others, lives with a self become Brahman. And remember that all these yamas and niyamas, the basic purifications and so forth, have to be observed in thought and feeling, in speech and in action. The Upanishads repeat this again and again, always in thought and feeling, in speech and in action. Now this is the preliminary. And then one comes to the practice of the postures, the yamas, asanas, and to pranayama. If there is the basis of purity, every asana, every posture, and remember that through the day the body is in some posture or other, you will find that every posture will express that which represents the transcendent reality of our existence. Observe in the ordinary way how a person walks, how he sits, how he stands, how he talks, how he comports himself. Doesn't that tell you a story? Every single posture is an interplay of your own living organism with the total universe. Leave alone the total universe, it's rather large, but it shows your interplay with your own immediate environment. How do I interplay with the environment? In terms of harmony, grace, beauty, in terms of real human relationship with everything, how do I interplay? What is my posture in relation to the situation now, here, inanimate, the chairs, the table, the room, etc., and animate, all of you? What is the relationship? Now you see, the posture has a significance, hasn't it? Any gesture that a man makes has its meaning, has it not? If we make gestures, if we adopt postures which are merely studied postures, because that is how we have been brought up very nicely and properly, you see, by the governess and whatnot, you see, then a person with any clear insight will see at once that this is just put on. It's a cloak. It isn't a reality. But the asanas of yogic training are calculated to so affect the body that the body will naturally have the right posture in any and every situation. So now, one begins to see something of the importance of posture. What does the Tejobindu Upanishad say with regard to the inner significance of posture? That should be known as asana, in which one can meditate uninterruptedly or undisturbed on Brahman and meditate with ease and without fatigue. The Mandala Brahmana, which is the most remarkable Upanishad really, the Mandala Brahmana says, being firm in the unshaken spiritual wisdom constitutes posture. These are statements which give you an insight into the esoteric significance and meaning of the physical training in postures. Now I've talked for well over the 3/4 of an hour, and I think it might be useful if I stopped there today and continue from there next time to complete the whole scope of yoga, as far as I'm able to. We have seen the meaning of yoga, we have seen its purpose. The meaning is to rejoin the separated individual to the totality. And the purpose of the training is obviously, therefore, to bring about this happy consummation. Thank you.